Hello, everyone. So nice to see that so many are here. And I just want to say a few words. And thank you very much for all that contributed during the weekend now and went to Oslo and here in Gjøvik as well. And we received very good feedback on what we presented and what, and people are very interested in us doing more stuff like that. So I'm right now in conversation with both Vitenscentret, the Science Museum here, but also some other institutions that work with children and elderly together. So we will, I will get back to that in next course. But now to this course, and I just want to say that Sebastian Brage Hansen, who were working with you on the prototyping and testing of prototypes, he will be, he comes tomorrow at 9 o'clock. And I know it said that we start 9:30, so it's fine if you come with the train, and then you just have to present later on. But how many here are able to join, start at 9 o'clock? Yeah. Okay. But that's, if you come later, it's not that critical. You will miss one presentation or something. This morning, Frode will talk until lunch. Yeah. And we will continue with some practical exercises after lunch, but we will not go on until very late. But and then, of course, there's the Make a Space design workshop tonight as well. And tomorrow, the morning will be Sebastian, and the afternoon will be about evaluation and lecture on evaluation, but also some practical work, how you can evaluate the design and the prototypes. And we will also have tomorrow afternoon, we will also have the possibility to talk about the exam, the home exam, and we could this afternoon also talk a bit about the different tasks you've been given, and maybe you have some questions to that. But the afternoon tomorrow will be with me and Øyvind. Okay, but then I leave it to...
When and where do they meet after lunch?
I wonder if we... I think it's better that we meet up in the makerspace in A2... Huh? 5-9, yeah. Okay. I put something up. I put a sign up on the room here.
Okay, you must be slightly tired of me now, as most of, quite a few of you are joining me up in the previous class from 8:15 this morning. But how many were not in that class? Yeah, there are quite a few. Okay. There's probably quite a few who don't follow that scientific methodology course at all. So I'm using a few examples that I have mentioned there as well, but it probably doesn't matter. This is not where I was supposed to be, was it? Supposed to start from the beginning, isn't that a good idea? Always. So what we are going to talk about, maybe not that much in a theoretical context. I'll try to be practical as well. But we'll talk about how humans process information and where we have difficulties, where we have challenges, where we have strengths, and how this, I'll try to relate that to some design issues. But some of it is theory as well, some of it is psychology. So we'll see how practical I can do this. As a basics here, the human mind is not a computer. We tend to use computer analogies a lot. We tend to refer to computers and how computers deal with information. And of course, to some extent, the mind is working as a computer, or the computer is simulating to work as the human mind. But in most cases, it isn't. It's applying completely different strategies. Computers are calculating things extremely rapidly, doing a lot of calculations. We are kind of slow. We are rather applying what we could call pattern recognition techniques, stuff like that in our brains. And our brains are, of course, extremely much slower than a computer, which works at the speed of light. Our neurons, even though they are kind of fast, they are a chemical process, and a chemical process is much slower than the speed of light. In addition to being a chemical system or being an electrochemical system, you also have a lot of slowness, meaning that. Even if a neuron sends a signal, the chance of that signal being repeated in the next neuron is kind of slim. It requires a lot of there is a lot of filtering going on. So it's a complicated system, which doesn't at all work like the computer. And as we try to treat information, we tend to treat it. By the way, these foils are now available in the Blackboard room, so you can find them there. You don't have to write everything down. We are extremely bad at we're kind of intuitive when we make decisions in the world. And of course, this is based on some obvious things. Our brains are kind of old, at least not the individual brain you have, but the brain as a structure is kind of old, and most of it is something we have in common with fish or whatever. Yeah, but it's true. We have some unique features as mammals. We have this cortex, which is the big thing on top of the brain, which is helping us in doing a lot of calculations, of course, but it's a thing that has developed over millions of years, and it hasn't changed, and it isn't going to change just because we're making graphical interfaces and walking around with small computers in our pockets or something like that. It's still the same brain. We think in the same way. It's not so that, I guess Sasha mentioned this in the previous lecture, it's not so that, for instance, our attention, the wisdom was that you can only attend to one thing at a time, consciously. That's still the case, even though you are sending 10 messages and looking at the movie at the same time. So what we do is that we switch between sources. So maybe we've learned to switch in a better way, but it's still, the brain works the same way. It still treats information in the same way. In the book, I mentioned this before, but I'll just repeat it as it is somewhat a basic thing. And it's become the modal theory of higher thinking and the way we treat complex information as humans. And that is the terminology and the knowledge that comes out of Kahneman and Tversky's research on how we handle information. The shortcomings we have and the strengths we have, but more than anything, the systematic bias that seems to occur when we handle information. I'm referring to an interview with Daniel Kahneman here. He got the Nobel Prize in was it economics, I think. Yeah. But he made some groundbreaking theories on how the brain functioned, and what they are mentioning a lot of the time is this, the system one and system two, as they refer to it, and this is a pretty nice demonstration of it. If you've been to one of my previous classes this year, you've seen this already. But it's a very good demonstration of what we call a system one and a system two way of handling information. And you can say the intuitive way of handling information is what we call the system one approach. And system one would probably give us the answer 10 cents to this thing here. So that's the intuitive way of doing this. But if we take a little bit of time, if we go back a step, and of course we understand that it would be too obvious that 10 was the answer here, then we need to apply some other way of thinking, and that takes time. It requires effort. 10 is the answer you would give if you were in a very stressed situation, if you were just giving away a very quick response. 5 would probably be the answer, right? If you are taking your time and trying to figure this out. You've seen this example before, right? Most of you. But it's a good example of a situation where our instinctive way of handling information takes us on wrong places. So what we call system one is then this, of course, the fast, the intuition-based way of, it's not applying very much of algorithmic thinking. It's not a very it has errors. It uses heuristics, rules of the thumb. It is unconscious. So this is the type of system that's in action when you don't have to think about things. But of course, in an adaptive way, without this way of handling information, we would be completely overloaded all the time. So a lot of most of our information handling is of this first kind, the kind that doesn't require any thinking at all, and it needs to be like that. Because we don't have unlimited resources, and we still have this old brain that only can attend to one thing at a time. And when it can attend to only one thing at a time, we wouldn't work if we had to think about everything. And this is the reason this is important also for design is that anytime you require people to think about what they have to do, well, they can't think of anything else at the same time. So pushing people into slow, systematic, controlled, and conscious thinking is usually not a very good thing to do. We'll try to discuss this a little bit later as well, because maybe it is a good thing to do now and then as well. But the general thing is that the advice is to let people do this in an automatic, easy way. And there are some things we are kind of good at doing. When we have learned that something works, when we have experienced some connection, we are extremely good at transferring that knowledge to other areas, and we are extremely good at generalizing from few experiences. You don't need to meet a leopard or something to know that you should avoid it, because you may have seen movies of it, and it's kind of natural to be scared of this, and you can generalize from that to lions or whatever, and you don't have to taste all bad smelling foods to avoid it in the future. It tends to be the natural thing to do, but of course you can learn to overrun this. So this is how we function in the world. We have to do this kind of generalization. We don't have to experience everything from the beginning. We will have to. It's okay to take this knowledge from one area to another area. But of course, there is also some, could say, backsides to this, because then you may also be wrong. So we tend to overgeneralize. Our natural thing to do is to try to generalize from a few, can be experiences or something that we have learned in other connections, but we tend to overgeneralize this, or at least generalize. It's natural for us to do that. We try to make sense of the world and make it into something that we can, where we can use our system one, and then it's okay. I'm not sure if it's a good example, but overgeneralization and our nature and the way we tend to do this. My mother and her sister came back from a vacation in Italy a couple of years ago. They were traveling by bus down Europe and up again. That's the type of vacation that generation tends to take now and then. And then they came back and told me that, they're not that good with food in Italy. Because they'd eaten on a lot of roadside restaurants, probably. They'd gotten a few bad experiences with overcooked pastas and prefabricated pizzas, which you probably get there, as you get everywhere in the world. And their natural way of interpreting things then was to say that, well, food in Italy isn't that bad, or isn't that good. But it's a natural thing to do. We try to make these kind of conclusions all the time. We generalize from a few experiences, and we make that into the general knowledge about things. So we won't always want to make information in such a way that we can apply our system one approach to the world. Other things we're quite good at is to automate things. And once you have learned something and automated it, it tends to stick to our mind for more or less some of it for the rest of our lives. Those of you who learned to ride a bicycle, and probably most of us, when we were kids, we can stop riding bicycles for tens of years, and you would still remember how to ride this bicycle, even though it's kind of difficult and complicated to do that. It requires a lot of fine-tuned skills, balance, to do it. But still, we can do it, and we can do it after years and years and years. And it creates automatic responses. And of course, driving is easy. Not necessarily driving to the workplace, let's say just the skill of driving is another example. It doesn't require attention at all, or conscious attention at all, under normal situations. Attention only kicks in when it's needed. So when you drive along a straight, nice highway under nice light conditions, it's probably not that dangerous to write a message on your phone. You shouldn't do that, but it would probably work. It would probably be quite fine. You can even browse, I guess, something. At least you can listen to the radio, and you can listen to the kids in the back seat. Fine. No problem at all. And then you get close to Oslo, and you have to read signs, and you have to attend to a lot of traffic. So what a lot of us tend to do then is that we tend to turn down the radio. We now and then shout at the kids to make them quiet. So we have to acquire, we have to attend to things. And when we have to attend to it, the driving, that is, that gets priority, then we can't attend to the rest of the... Then the rest becomes noise that distracts us and requires us to shut down that type of noise. So the point is here, as when you can automate things, we need to automate a lot of things because we need to do a lot of things at the same time. So we need to automate all these things. But when it's automated, it also may create difficulties, of course. The example here with driving to the same workplace after many years has its downsides as well. I don't know how many have... I don't know if all of you are driving cars, but most of us have experienced that we end up, when we lose attention, when we lose some focus, we now and then end up where we didn't want to end up. We turn right in the crossing where we usually turn right when we're going to work, for instance, instead of driving straight ahead because we were going to the shop instead. So we do these mistakes. That has to do with this automatization of attention. But the nice thing with this automatization is that then we can do a lot of things at the same time. And of course, it would be hard to work or to function in the world if we can do something like that. But of course, some things are hard for us to do. For instance, doing new things. Because doing new things always requires attention until it is acquired as a skill. So we always have to, when we're learning something, we have to attend to it. In most cases. Um, And that has consequences. And of course, this has highly relevant also for learning computers or learning how to do things in a user interface. Because if you have to do things in a new way, it will take focus away from the tasks that you're going to do when you are using, for instance, a user interface. You can't do many of these things at once. You can probably only attend to one such thing at a time. So then, when in automated mode, in system one mode, you can do a lot of things more or less in parallel. When you are in this system two mode, you can't do many things. You have to do things in, if you're doing several things, you have to switch between them. And then you can't switch between too many either. So maybe there are some learned skills here involved. But in general, kicking you into system two thinking also kicks you into, I guess, not bad performance, but at least kicks you into a situation where you can't do too much at a time. And the driving example is such an example. The thing that didn't require attention in the first hand, when that becomes a system two way, where you have to problem solve, where you have to find your way, where you have to look at a lot more traffic and interpret that, that makes it impossible for us to take in all the rest of the information. You can't listen to the radio in parallel to that work situation, and you can't talk to the kids in a calm way in that situation. And there are a lot of examples on this, and you can just... this is an easy one for us. This is automized, right? A, B, C, D, E, F, G. You don't have to. You can do that easily. You probably can't stop exactly at M, because you may just continue as it is a long line we have overtrained. But if you're asked to do it the other way around, it's very difficult, right? You can't do it. Probably. But you will do errors. It will take a lot of time before it's practiced to a level where you actually can use it. But it's just that this requires a whole different set of attention. And you can't do... You could probably still be writing a message, even if you were, or at least continue playing a video game while you were reciting the alphabet forward. But if you were going to do it the other way, no way. You may have entered situations like this. I shouldn't tell you to do this. It's probably some information security people who think that this is a very bad idea to let you do. But have it as a thought example and try it for yourself. This is overtrained, right? You have these keypads all the time, and you... Even if you don't remember the PIN code, if you can't recite it, it's usually now and then a good idea to just try it. And you may actually end up doing it right without being able to remember it after summer or something. But works fine. But try to do the same thing, at least under stressed situations, on a linear keyboard. Or on the number keys you have on your computer. just try it mentally. It's a lot more difficult. You have to attend to it. You have to focus on it to be able to do it. Even small changes can be extremely difficult. I was struggling getting money out of Spanish mini banks or ATMs. Because they have, by some reason, at some point of time, they had established another configuration of the keypad. 9 was where the 1 is, or something like that. There was something with that keypad that was different. Have you experienced something like this? Some countries have 2 configurations all the time, so you go into these situations all the time. But then you may compensate by learning that as well. But for us who was used to one sort of keypad, it was extremely difficult to handle. Even though you know the numbers.
There was a Japanese study about the correlation between the disposition of the key on the keypad for ATM. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
And they found out that not only that there is an high correlation and they are more or less the same, but also Israeli scientists tried it again to see if there was a strong bias because they were Japanese. The same thing in Israel.
It doesn't matter, right? The point is you have to standardize. And once you're standardizing, I think that was their point, wasn't it?
So
it doesn't matter how you configure things usually. just do it in one way.
The most natural way was the most normal way.
Yeah. So your reading pattern doesn't matter. The standardize. And that's also the knowledge, of course. That's how this generalizes back to design. Standardize. What's even more difficult for us, and this is where we are going now, is problem solving. That is, approaching things where you don't know the answer, where you have to do calculations in some way, where you have to apply some reasoning, where you have to apply some deduction, or even worse, where you have to do some real calculations with numbers. And this is something we're absolutely not, or could say the at least not the primitive parts of our brains aren't at all into this thing. So it's very hard usually to automate things. So once you're in a problem solving situation, you're almost always in the system two. At least to actually solve problems, you are in the system two mode, the conscious, controlled mode. And of course all this problem solving is difficult for us to do. It always takes a lot of resources from us. But it's of course an interesting area, and it's not only a negative thing, of course, because we tend to like problem solving as well. As humans, we tend to like to play with problems. So we don't want necessarily to be in this automatic mode all the time. But it is difficult for us. And take something like calculations, for instance, where you have to add numbers to things, which is something we do all the time in our world. We count things, we add things together. We make natural subtractions when people leave a group, for instance. We know how many is left. You read recipes for how to put things together. All sorts of difficult situations. And doing calculations is something that humans haven't done. Well, even though you could say the brain is millions of years and the human brains has hardly developed in tens and thousands of years. Applying calculations can't be traced more than, at least according to your course book, more than, I think, the Babylonians or something did this some 3,000 years before Christ. Where they started to develop a numeric systems for trade. And that's probably in history the first recorded use of numbers. And that's even a more, although you can automize some types of problem solving, moving into the area of doing calculations is very strengthful for us and can only be done in a system 2 mode, a controlled, monitored mode. Of course, this InDesign means that requiring people to do calculations manually is the absolute worst thing you can do if you want to have them attend to something else than the calculation itself. So that's something that's good that we have computers for. Now you can think about this a little bit. This is classical problem, if it comes to problem solving. It's called I think it was Carl Duncker, I think. It was a Gestalt psychologist working, mainly producing his things in the 40s and early 50s, where he developed some problem-solving tasks that has made us learn a lot about how we handle information, Not only that we are in the system 2 way, but how we actually treat information and the difficulties we may have with handling information in the world around us. And this is called the candle problem, where Duncker gives us or gives the test subjects three things. He gives them a few matches. Matchbook, maybe that's what it's called. And an unlit candle and a box with, is it called thumbtacks? Tegnestifter. And your task is, you also have a corkboard, by the way, on the wall. So your task is to get a burning candle up on the corkboard that hangs on the wall. How would you do this? Some of you know the answer. I can see some smiles here. Does everyone know? Who knows the answer to this? I think two. Okay. Give it a minute, discuss it with your neighbor. Thank you. Okay, shouldn't be too difficult, should it? It should be a simple problem, right? Get a burning candle up on the wall. Any suggestions? Anyone dares to come up with a suggestion? Not you.
We have a plan.
You have a plan? Okay.
Either we embed a few nails into the candle, warming them up, and then...
Okay. Melt some, melt it a little bit and try to make it stick. Okay. I can't rule out that it may work, but I think there are simpler solutions.
Me?
Yeah?
Yeah. Basically, take the box of tags, might turn it on that. Just use tags to connect the box to the wall and melt some of. Yeah.
That's it.
Theory, okay.
this is the solution that is written as the best solution on this problem. But always give you a result. Maybe it's a light candle, so it won't be a problem. Very few handle it. I think it's down to 5% in a population that tends to handle it. If they get some time to work with it, it gets a lot better. And of course, what we could do was to apply good designs to help us do this. For instance, if you present this problem in a very different way, for instance, if you empty the box of thumbtacks first, if you show the thumbtacks on the side and then the box and then the candle, some 40% or something will handle the situation. So it's a dramatic change if you just by giving them a good I don't remember the numbers here, so take them for what they are, something that I just make up now. Anyway, the thing is, it's difficult for us, but it gets easier if you present the problem in a very clean way, or if you change the way you present things. And you don't always know this, of course, so this is typically something you would have to test out what works here. And another thing that we know is affecting situations like this is the type of jive, the kind of arousal that you put into the situation on the people who's going to try to solve this situation. Because they, for instance, a variety of this problem has been to apply some kind of a competition where you get paid according to how fast you solve the problem. And that's shown to be not a very clean-cut thing to do. Actually, if you put that type of high-jive situations up here, if you make this into something you're paid to do fast, the number who actually manages to solve a task like this in an intuitive, fast way becomes lower. So putting pressure on problem solving is probably not a very good idea. Okay, time for a break, right? I forgot the time here, sorry. Just seem all right when you're talking anyway. What this is usually referred to as, and this is another thing that comes into, that's relevant, directly relevant, I think, for designs. The explanation for problems like the one we had in this Dunker problem was, or is usually said to be something called functional fixedness. That once we have established one way of using something, we tend to stick to that usage. And the in this problem we just, in the candle problem we just mentioned, the fixedness seems to be that the box is supposed to be for the thumbtacks, not for the candle. That's what it's used for. Another very nice demonstration, I was thinking about doing it, but I didn't get the time to do it, is this two-string problem by Meyer, which is another example of something similar, where you have two strings down from the ceiling. They're too far apart for you to reach them, and even if you take one of them, you can't reach the other one. So your task is to tie them together. And people can use hours on this task. You have a few helpers here, because you have either scissors or tongue. I don't know what that is in English. Huh? Pliers. You have that available. You may have a few more items. You have a chair. And you usually tend to start using the pliers here, and you try to use that to extend your hand and stuff like that, and to clip it to one of the strings and try to draw it together. There is we won't spend time on this now. There is a simple solution which has to do with functional fixedness, because you can't. It's not obvious that what you should use these pliers for is to tie it to one of the strings and make it swing like that, and then you can grab the other rope and walk over silently and just grab it when it's there, and then you have them together and you can tie them together. So it's. But it's hard for us to use something we know how to be used in another context. Of course, it tells us something about how design of tool lines, the objects, icons. Once they have a usage, once there is an established usage of something, it's difficult for us to use it in another way. So, functional fixedness. Other things we have difficulties with is to move outside the boundaries of. I've already given you an answer here now by introducing it like that. That was maybe not so good. Your task here is to connect these dots. These nine dots. You have a pencil. You are to draw a continuous line or straight lines that goes together. So your task is to make one continuous or four lines. That's the total of lines you're going to do. But you're not allowed to take the pencil up from the sheet. Once you have started. And you should draw four straight lines, and by drawing these four straight lines, you should be able to cover all these nine dots. It seems kind of. You can try it. I see that a few of you are trying now to to draw this. Everyone has seen this in some variety, right? I'm not sure if I have some. I can just point it out. The point is that these seem to limit our action somehow. They are in a square, and we try all varieties 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, right? We try tend to do things like that, which don't work. It can't work. So what you have to do is that you have to think outside the obvious limits that is shown in the task. What you have to do here is that there are several solutions actually, but what you have to do is to go down here with your line and then continue up here like that. So you have to move outside the actual boundaries, and once you have you learn how to do that, it becomes a doable task. But somehow displaying some limits, like what you do in a graphical way here, is limiting our capability of solving a problem. So I have a few others here you can find later, but these are called transformation and insight problems. But let me just jump to another type of problems that also gives us some direct links to how we can make it easier for people to handle situations. And that's called analogous. Let's just try this one. You want to do these things, right? This is a classic. This is a written down version of, again, Dunkey. And his radiation problem. Maybe you haven't met this one. It's also a classical one. But it requires a bit more. It should be easier for us maybe today. Remember, this was done in the 40s. Let me just phrase it in a short way. You are a doctor faced with a little bit of a problem. You have this fine device, which is able to burn away a cancer or a tumor. The tumor is hidden well or deep inside the body somewhere. So in order to kill this tumor, you have to apply enough energy in this radiation beam that you are using to kill the tumor. But in order to kill the tumor, you would also the same energy that you apply to kill the tumor would also kill healthy tissue. But you don't want to do that. You only want to kill the tumor. So how do you solve something like this? How can you make sure that you only treat the tumor and kill that and not healthy tissue? It's nice to take try to solve it. Use 3-4 minutes and try to solve it. Talk to your neighbors and come up with solutions for this one. Okay, solutions.
Yeah. Should I take the answer or just the solution?
Do you know the solution? Then you then skip it.
Simple, so.
Don't give the. No, come on. If you know it, don't tell me.
Well, if the question is
How to reach the tumor.
Destroy the tumor without destroying the healthy tissue.
Yeah.
You take out the tumor and then use a razor net. No,
you
can,
yeah. You would kill the tumor, but you won't save the patient, right? No, that's not a low answer, huh?
You are obliged by Hippocrates, so you cannot do that.
There are some ethical concerns here. But you're not. We're doing this all the time. Applying radiation to kill tumors. It was new in the 40s. It isn't new anymore. We do this all the time. So there is a solution. Yeah. No, but this is the problem is real. This is if you're going to do something in deep inside the brain, for instance, there are ways to do this. There is a solution. Okay, nobody have a direct answer. You have a correct answer as well.
Yeah.
Okay, but let me wait, and I'll just show you one way of making this a bit easier. Because if we started out with the second story, that you have an army here and you want to attack someone. That's a very different story, but it can be used as an analog for solving the situation. So, does anyone come up with new ideas when you read that story, if you're able to read it from distance? Somehow? Read it now? Yeah? Divide the beams. Divide them into three beams, for instance, and make them meet at the point where the tumor is. That's the solution. That's the only point that would get radiation levels above what kills healthy tissue. So it's just an example of how you can improve things by applying analogies in the presentation of a problem. Actually, in the you're not. It's kind of strange that this radiation problem. Radiation is so common now, it has been for tens of years, like 50 years or something. It was new in the 40s, of course, and it was the surprise that only some 4% or something, 5% of his population actually managed to solve this problem. But it's strange that it is like this today. So it's actually common knowledge today that only some 10% of us today can handle this or can come up with an intuitive, quick solutions. We tend to add some surgery or something like that and try to put an envelope around the tumor, and then but it's too complicated. There is a solution to this one. And only 10% today can actually handle this. But if we put this analog or parallel story in beforehand, which is a nice way to do it when you're helping people with problem solving, it's much easier, and you would probably most of us would be able to solve the situation if we did that. You did it right away, right?
You probably need to be a little bit more certain. You probably need to know a little bit about basic technology, and then that you can have a beam of radiation and
Probably we don't know much more. That's as a common people, you don't know much more about how this is done, probably. So, but again, analog stories helps us a little bit. Just a preliminary sum up. It's probably a good idea not to. Push us with things that we are bad at. We can, of course, do some easy things without putting strain on our system, like things we have overlearned in some way. There is a reason why we learn these gangetabeller, these tables of computing. I don't know what they're called. Gangetabeller in Norwegian. Because when they are learned in that way, we can automize them quite easily. But if we have to do the calculations, it's extremely hard. And if, of course, the some type of calculations are so hard for us to do that we can't even rely on what we can work with all the time, we have to put away calculations that are done and retrieve them from long-term memory. If you're going to do a calculations like the one you have on the bottom there, you would probably have to apply some. The first thing to do would probably be to take 93.3 times 100 or something. Then you would remember that number and put that away maybe in long-term or some semi-long-term memory. At least put it away a little bit and then do another calculation. 2.1 times 93.3 or something like that. Or you would even divide it into one more sub-calculation. And of course, having to do things like that is way beyond what can be automized in any way. So, and there are other things that we are bad at, like doing complicated types of diagnostic work, for instance, on technology. We're extremely bad at this, or it requires attention from us. But on the other hand, as I said, we are somewhat drawn towards these things as well as humans. There are situations where we actually want to do this. We like to play with things that will occupy our mind. Right? We do Sudokus. We do crosswords, puzzles. We spend a lot of time, some of us, trying to solve these types of problems that I've presented for you now. It's fun to do it, right? So, but not all things are fun. And one particular thing that's not usually not very fun to do for most people, and that we're especially bad at, are these things that has to do with handling numbers, calculating numbers. So that's something we're bad at. So automate it when you can. It's just an example. These are the... You could say the advices that your book gives you on what you should do to make an interface as useful as possible. Let people do things in an automatic learned way. That is system one. So you don't have to think about the software, and you can maybe focus on the problem that you're using the software to solve in some way. So then you can allocate your limited serial mental resources to one task at a time. And once you have to apply some kind of problem solving, where you have to apply some kind of, where you have to pick out the right elements from your long time memory in a conscious way. When you do that, and you have to deduce things, you have to make analogous. Well, maybe the example here is probably a good one. They want my member ID. Is that the same as username? Is it the same as my mail address? What username does this refer to? Well, then I have to apply my mind. I have to kick myself into system two to be able to solve that. And even more, minimize any need for actually calculations, because that's what we're absolutely worst at doing manually ourselves. So, but of course, this also raises some discussions. So you can think a little bit about this, because the advice here is to lull the user into automated processes all the time. That's what we should aim for in a good user-friendly system that makes things useful. But is it always a good thing? If you want people to be creative, if you want people to apply a critical way of thinking about things, if you want to make people solve new problems, think about new things, is this a good thing? Yeah, of course, in most cases, probably right. These advices that you get here, because the advice is don't make the users think, seems to be the message. But is it always right? Think about something. Let's take an example. An expert system. Your doctor is probably using one today, or maybe not, but in the very short future he will probably use an expert system as an aid for getting to the right diagnosis. It is it's applied in many sectors today. But if you take this a bit further, do you actually want him to use this? Well, do you need the doctor there then if he's using an expert system? It's somewhat the same discussion, right? Yeah, but maybe it will. Well, the math is probably that it's a good thing. But what will happen in the long run for new knowledge, for instance. I'm not sure. It's not an easy debate. Because I'm not sure that if my doctor uses something like this, the reason he uses it is to get advice, and then he should be critical and see whether the proper this is a good advice, or if in your case there is so much uncertainty connected to this suggestion that it may be something else, that he should check something else that the expert system maybe didn't come up with. Maybe the existence of a system that gives him advice makes him less critical. Because we were doing something similar 15 years back in a nuclear power plant simulator where I worked, where we were developing operator support systems. So the operators should have help to do diagnosis of a rather complicated situation that they were facing. And we made them, they were looking at the simulator where some pumps tripped and some water leaked and lots of things went wrong. So it was kind of complicated to come to the right diagnose. Maybe they couldn't do it themselves, so they were absolutely helped by the system. But what we did was that we gave them situations both with and without the operator support system or the diagnostic system there, and we took out verbal protocols where they told us what they were thinking about all the time, and we counted the number of working hypotheses they had, they were handling all the time. Because that's what we want them to do, right? We want them to try out different alternatives to check out and come to the right conclusion. And these operators, when they got this system, more than half their number of work hypotheses. So they were actually changing their way of thinking about the situation by being lulled into trusting the system. The system was, of course, right, but it could also be wrong. It could be that it didn't have all the necessary rules there. And another area where this has been thought of as an issue is on, for instance, on creative thinking. If you want to make people make something new, come up with new ideas, make new politics, it's probably a good idea to kick them out of these automatic type one sort of processes. So I think it's something you should think about now and then when you discuss kind of user friendliness in different ways. Okay, that was one of the debates here. I have a few more problem-solving things, but at some point we'll have to stop this. Most of you have seen this. It's in Norwegian, but you can live with that. But you've seen it. It's a version of this Weissen's four-card problem on reasoning, where I say that if a card has vowel on one side, it has an even number on the other side. What or which cards needs to be turned around to confirm the rule or to confirm the statement? And as you remember, there were different versions here. A lot of you tended to want to turn the number 7 there, even though the rule doesn't say anything about what's on the back of an even number.
Would demand an extra rule of saying implicitly that there is a number.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Don't make it too difficult. Most people can handle this. Okay. Okay, but let's say that that's part of the statement then. These cards have a number on one side and a letter on the other side. Okay? If it's a vowel on one side, it's an even number on the other side. Satisfied? Good. even if I said that, most of you would turn, about half of you would probably turn around the 7. It's a natural thing for us to do. All of you would turn around the A. Some would turn around the K. Some would turn around the 4. So but the thing is here, we tend to want to confirm a hypothesis rather than trying to falsify it. But you can make things like this a lot more easy by making it relevant. Because this is an abstraction. Here we're dealing with vowels and even and odd numbers. Hard for us to do. Calculations, abstractions. If we make things relevant for real life situations. And rephrase this and say that on these cards there is a drink on one side and a number on the other side. And an H on the other side. So that was the rephrasing, right? You're satisfied now? And the statement says, if one is underage, that's under the age of 18, one drinks non-alcoholic beverages. What cards do you need to turn around to confirm this rule? It actually, when you do things like this, when you apply this story to it, it becomes a lot easier for us. You don't need to turn around the 23-year-old. You don't say anything about him. But what you probably would want to do was at least you will turn around the 14 and see what he's drinking, right? And he should then drink non-alcoholic. But you should also turn one more. And that is the beer thing, right? So that is the solution here. It's the same solution as you had on the previous one, but it's a lot easier. A lot more people gets to this this answer than in the previous one. Because it is probably it's something we know about in real life. We don't have to use abstract problem-solving strategies to get to the right answer here. Let's see. What have we time to do now? Maybe we can take a few words on this, because this was an area where I won't make you do a task analysis now, but maybe have you done any task analysis in this course? You will do it in the. There probably isn't time to do a thorough task analysis, but a very common thing to do in a user-centered process is at some stage to try to describe the actual tasks that's going to be performed on a system, both to quantify what types of information is new and old information, what the goals actually are, what the tasks are that needs to be performed, their rarity, how common they are occurring. Etc. It's a big area. It's books on this task analysis and task analysis techniques. But it's usually a good idea to get an idea about the requirements on the user in a given system. And it's usually at least one very common way of doing a task analysis in form of something called a hierarchical task analysis. So if you see this acronym HTA, or hear people talk about HTAs, they always do that in among interaction designers. You meet this word now and then. It usually means a way to that you are trying to decompose the tasks that's going to be performed in a way that makes it possible for you to actually describe more in detail what type of support is required. Is this an action that, is this a task that occurs seldom, or does it occur all the time? Because support will probably be different if it occurs all the time compared to if it occurs very seldom. And an HTA usually then decomposes things in a way like this. You have a major goal on top. The task here is to clean your house with a vacuum cleaner. And in order to do that, you have a number of subtasks. Well, you have to get the vacuum cleaner out of the cupboard or out of where it's located. Then you have to fix the appropriate attachments to it. Then you have to walk around, clean the rooms. Then you empty the dust bag, maybe, if it's needed. And maybe that could be even an over on our vacuum cleaners. It's probably something you will also check in the beginning at some point, whether it's full or not. And then put everything away. But this just give an overview. So what they do in an IHTA is to try to decompose things further. Some of these tasks probably needs to be described more in details. So clean rooms, what rooms needs to be cleaned. And maybe for some of them you need to use different equipment or something like that. And then you also write plans in between. So you say something about the sequence where things is going to be performed and when they are going to be performed. So point 3.1, clean the hall, is done every day. Living rooms is done once a week. And bedrooms on some other, based on some other rule. One of the reasons why this is so, as I said, useful is that it helps us identify in a very detailed way what requirements there are from the users, but it also allows you to maybe quantify actually what's going to be done and how fast things can be done. Because there are, for instance, models for doing task analysis in a quantifiable way, not only describe the process, but also add numbers to it. You have, for instance, one type of task analysis called GOMS analysis, goals, operators, methods, selection rules. It's kind of similar to the hierarchical task analysis, but in this case, you actually put numbers on the different operations that users need to apply in order to solve something. You know how much time a keystroke takes. You can see different numbers on this. Your book also mentions some of these numbers. And they may be a little bit different. These are old numbers. But it tells you that you can improve efficiency of a system by applying the correct input methods and the correct mental or the choice of automated and controlled processes, maybe. Because some actions of pushing keys on a keyboard is easy for us to do. It's fast. This mean time of 4 per second is what you can see here. But moving your hand from the mouse to the keyboard takes, well, almost half a second, or 400 milliseconds. And doing the pointing operations, depending, of course, on, I think Sasha mentioned Fitt's law or something, will take at least a second, often more, if the pointing is to be very precise and where you have to slow down a lot before you actually do the pointing. So that takes more time. And if you, in addition, have to apply some kind of a mental operation where you have to choose between different methods, different input methods, etc., this is even more time demanding. So just gives you an idea that at least this was only to mention the name HDA and to say what it's used for and how different varieties of task analysis can be used for different things, but it's a very common method to try to quantify and describe the actions involved in interaction with a system. And we have skipped that somehow in this course. But you will do this probably with Sashi next semester, and with those of you who are taking the continuation of this course. So, okay, I had a lot of had more problem solving, and I had a bit on learning. So you can probably just look through the slides and see whether that's you can learn something from that. This is as far as we got today. So have a good lunch and have a good exam. This is the last point where I meet you. So. Good luck.